Welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. On each episode, we talk with biographers about their work. This time, award-winning archaeologist, author, and scholar Cheryl LaRoche talks about her latest book, Apostle of Liberation, AME Bishop Paul Quinn and the Underground Railroad. Published this month by Roman and Littlefield, it explores the remarkable life of African Methodist Episcopal Church bishop and activist Paul Quinn. Cheryl LaRoche was interviewed by fellow biographer and bio member Kevin Magruder.
Welcome, Cheryl.
Oh, thank you for having me.
To start off, can you talk about why we should know the importance of Paul Quinn?
Well, it has occurred to me that Paul Quinn's story is probably never more relevant than it is today. He was a man of the 19th century, a circuit rider, a bishop, an Underground Railroad operative, but a man who stood in opposition to the political moment that he found himself in. And his life is instructive for those people who find that they are perhaps either at odds or want to see a change in the way things are going. And he really did figure out how to be effective in an oppositional environment. He was very much involved in spreading the AME denomination across the country into Canada. He helped send missionaries to Haiti. He sent a missionary out to California during the time of the gold rush. And so I think that reading and understanding his life is instructive for people who want to bring about change.
Where was he born and how did he get connected with the AME Church?
Well, after much research and speculation, we know now that he was born in Belize in British Honduras in the late 18th century. He was an immigrant. His father was a Spanish mahogany dealer, and his mother was said to be East African. After being disowned by his father because of his Christian leanings, we believe his father may have been Catholic, Quinn was sort of exiled, found his way to the UK, and then eventually came to the United States, where he interacted with local Quakers. Elias Hicks, if that name rings a bell, was one of the more radical Quakers of the time, took Quinn in Jericho, Long Island, when Quinn first arrived on these shores.
And he was a young adult.
It's tough to pin down his age and the time. He was probably, I don't know, maybe 18, I would say. We don't have precise years for him in terms of when that was, but he was a young adult. And Elias Hicks was quite radical in his thinking. He advocated what we would call reparations today. He advocated full equality for African Americans. And Quinn, as a young man, first engaged with probably some of the deeper theoretical understandings of slavery and escaped from slavery through Elias Hicks.
And how does he go from being connected with Elias Hicks to the African Methodist Episcopal Church?
As he is moving around, coming out of Long Island, he comes into Pennsylvania and he hears a preacher. This is a Black man. This is before now the establishment of the AME denomination. So Black preachers and aspirants, or anyone who wanted to have a religious calling, most of the people who are preaching in this time period begin with the Methodist Episcopal Church. And so Reverend Collins, is a man he saw in Pennsylvania, helped him to get an exhorter's license, because as Black people, you could not preach directly for the Methodist Episcopal Church. There was a lot of racism, and there was a limit on what you could do as a preacher for the Methodist Episcopal Church. And so when finally Collins takes Quinn to the foundation, to the founding of the AME Church, and that's how Quinn intersects with African Methodism with Richard Allen, and with what would end up being, his career path for his religious calling for the rest of his life.
For those who aren't familiar with the founding of that denomination, can you give us a brief description of how that comes about?
I spend a good bit of the early chapter in really clarifying this because I found that people don't quite understand the full sort of intricacies of the formation of the AME Church and of the Black Church in general. So, across the country, in New York, in Philadelphia, in Baltimore, even out in Maryland and Virginia and Washington, D.C., Blacks are being segregated in the white churches. And that segregation means they can't sit together. They're being put in pews that are really unacceptable. They're being sent up to dusty galleys. They're not being able to come to the worship altar to communion until after everyone else has been served. And this unchristian-like behavior pushes many of the early Black preachers to start their own Black churches. When Richard Allen calls for a sort of a meeting, a conference, he brings together several heads of Black churches in different states, in Delaware, in New York, in Pennsylvania, to come together and form one African Methodist church. This is 1816 when the church starts, but he and Absalom Jones had been working before that in a separate society. They
Okay.
finally pull them together. They've all I would say since the American Revolution to 1816, you have this formation of the foundation of these individual Black denominations. They all come to Allen and they come to the formation of the African Methodist Church. They don't all join. New York notably doesn't join. And when New York doesn't join, they form the African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church. But those are the ways in which they first came together. And Hal Quinn, who was quite young, was just a doorkeeper. He just was there to serve food and interact, but he knew all of the early founders of the church. So he was there from the beginning and was one of the first of the itinerants and the first one to mount a horse. I mean, the thing about Quinn that to me is fascinating is, he's a horseback rider. He's out on a horse in the West. And when we think about the tales of the West, when we think about all the Westerns we've seen, when we think about all the movies that we've seen, there's never been one that actually touched on the type of life that Paul Quinn led.
Well, I live in Yellow Springs, Ohio, and we're in the 3rd District, and I belong to Central Chapel AME Church. And I think we become a district in the 1830s. And just having driven from here east, those mountains are a barrier, and the AME Church is crossing them. I always imagine wagons or something like that, but he's on a horse
He's on a horse.
doing it alone often as well. And that's just kind of the tale of movies or something.
When you read the accounts, and of course, these aren't his words. Often there are other accounts where he's told people and they recreate it. If he had written his own account, we would have the most fascinating story because he is crossing the mountains. He is traveling across these rivers. He is moving through some very rugged terrain to spread this word of God. When he is a little older and a little more established, he does have a wagon. He has his own coach, his own carriage. And I believe that part of the beauty of him having that is that he was able to help people escape, more than likely using his carriage as well. And one of the things that I use in this analysis, because I think if you look, there are just so many different ways to approach this topic to get at it. And I use a geography as one of them. So, he's talking about the Alleghenies, he's talking about the Monongahela River, he's talking about all these places that he has to, really get across and move through to establish these different churches. He covers at least somewhere between 15 and 17 states. And as he moves across the country, he finds these small prayer bands, the people who have come together to pray, praying societies, and he organizes them into congregations. That's how he begins to lay the foundation for the church. And at the same time, he's also laying the foundation for the Underground Railroad. Among the dozens of things that were just huge revelations for me. This understanding that he is, in many ways, I call him in the book the engineer of the Underground Railroad. He's laying out these routes. And I believe as we continue to look, we're going to see, as we have already, but more definitively, that these Underground Railroad routes coincide with the AME Church. That's very powerful.
Definitely. Often, because there's an article that you're probably familiar with by a man named Siebert. He was at Ohio State in the 1890s, and
Yes.
he has a map of the Underground Railroad, and Ohio is dense in terms of routes. And it would be fascinating to overlay that with AME churches. People had to stop somewhere if they're on the Underground Railroad, and sometimes it might have been private homes, but why not a church? Because they have a certain level of safety, more than a private home in some ways, probably.
Well, and they call it a sanctuary, and
Right.
yes.
Right.
And you're right on target. I have been studying GIS, map making, and looking at Siebert's map much more carefully from a modern perspective of what can we learn through GIS with Siebert's map. But I don't have all of the AME churches of that time period mapped out. And so that's a huge sort of research problem that has to be addressed before we can actually do the work that you're suggesting and that I envision.
Can you talk about first what were the responsibilities as an itinerant, and then how Paul Quinn moves from that to church leadership?
So the responsibilities really begin with an exhorter, which is what he begins as. And an exhorter is someone who really has to quickly move in and exhort with powerful prayer, bring a person into the fold, back to Christ, into the church. He does this for the Methodist Episcopal Church because that's what Blacks could do. After you become an exhorter, he then moved on to the itinerant system, and you're just moving from place to place. But because he was such a powerful organizer and was able to show his genius in the layout of the circuits, so many of the circuits that probably still exist, I would have to again study it, were probably initially laid out by Paul Quinn, particularly the ones in Western Pennsylvania, in northern parts of Maryland, out to Pittsburgh, in Ohio for sure, and in Indiana. And so,
And when he moved on, did he move on when he had identified leadership to carry on that particular church?
he would generally come and identify the most capable person he could find who had maybe been a leader in some form or who showed some capacity. And he would pretty much empower them right on the spot to say, you will be the class leader. You will be leading Bible studies. And can you read? Literacy is a huge issue. And more often than not, though, the people that he may have empowered did not have capacity to read or write at that time. And so he moves through these forms of organization, and Alan is very quick to recognize his capacity and keeps sending Quinn to New York City, for example, and sending him out to conquer these various places. But it also appears to me, and this is just my own opinion, that he's working somewhat independently as well. And so by the time the church officially recognizes its conferences out in the West, Quinn's been out there for quite some time. So even though, you might see a conference date of 1836, we know Quinn was there before to get it all organized.
And then at one point, he seems to separate
Yes.
from the denomination, and you examine what might have been happening there.
Yeah, it's not clear whether he separated himself or was separated because I think he incurs Richard Allen's wrath. Now, understand that Allen has set the example. He has started an independent church. He and the people that were around him, the men who came together to form the AME Church and those who decided not to join him, were all working in independent denominations. And so Allen had actually sort of laid the groundwork for independence. And so Quinn in New York seems to have moved into an independent church and established it and gotten his location and probably had about 150 members.
And this
And
is the
Alan,
1840s when this is
oh, no,
happening.
this is in the 1820s.
Okay.
And Richard Allen had sent Quinn to New York to conquer New York for AME. New York had always been an outlier. AME Zion Church had resisted his overtures to join AME. And so New York was a place where Richard Allen really wanted to succeed. And what does Quinn do? He goes and he succeeds, but he does it independently. And that was grounds, I believe, for his dismissal from the church. But, Richard Allen dies while Quinn is in New York. And Quinn quickly, under Morris Brown, the second bishop of the AME Church, Quinn quickly comes back into the denomination with the death of Allen, and he never looks back. But I do think that history, that breach, has slowed down our understanding of Quinn, because I think that the AME Church has never really resolved their feelings about that separation, as far as I can tell.
So he's coming back, not quite the prodigal son, but very soon he's in leadership.
Very soon. Morris Brown always saw Quinn's capacity. And think about Morris Brown now. He's now the head of the church. Allen is sick and then dies. He needs good leadership. He needs strong leaders. And he knew Quinn was quite capable and sent Quinn out west immediately upon Allen's death to sort of get him out of the east and move him into the area where there's the greatest amount of potential and possibility for growth.
And by West, for our listeners,
Oh,
can you define, because it's a little bit different than what we think now?
that's true. West in that period would have been from Pittsburgh out. Even Pittsburgh is considered the West. And so the Western Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois, anything to the Mississippi, that was considered the early West. And that's where he goes. And I believe he's out in these areas unofficially before he begins his official role for the church. So he knows that territory by the time he is sent out officially by the AME Church. He's already been there.
And then eventually he becomes bishop. And what does that mean for him?
He does become bishop. By the time 1844 comes, Quinn had been to every church. He had been everywhere you can think of. And so he was quite well known. And he actually goes after the position, gives a stellar report, talks about all the schools that he had started, all the churches he had started, all of the teachers that were under him. His report from 1844 is one of the most easily accessible documents that you can find on the AME Church. And so that report won for him the position of the bishop. He was the fourth bishop. The third bishop was pretty inactive. And so Morris Brown was carrying all of this alone and was very much in need of strong leadership.
How many churches would there have been at that time?
I hesitate to give you a number because I might be
Yeah,
wrong.
understand. But it's many.
It's many, yes.
Dozens, probably,
Does.
at
Oh,
least.
yes, absolutely, yes.
And then his work as a bishop, he eventually ends up being the only bishop for a
Yeah.
period.
Oh, yes. Well, he's the only bishop for a period because Daniel Payne is the bishop that comes after Quinn. And Quinn had tried to recruit Payne very early on, and Daniel Payne, A, had just been assigned to be the historian for the church, and he wanted to get that together. Thank goodness he did. And so he was reluctant to take on the role of bishop. And remember that this is one of the most significant positions a Black man could achieve and attain in this country at the time. And Daniel Payne felt himself wholly unworthy. Now, mind you, he's trained academically, he's got the credentials, he's been trained by the Presbyterians. And so he's probably one of the most qualified people, but he resisted. And when he resisted, Quinn then had to carry on alone for 4 more years until Payne finally said yes.
And the book ends looking at what Quinn had accomplished in 50 years of being there from the beginning of the denomination. And probably very few people within denominations play that role. What do you think contributed to his enduring leadership, but his success
His
as
success.
well?
You feel like when you write someone's biography, you really do feel like you get to know them on multiple levels. And I feel like in some ways I know the secular man and the sacred. He had a wonderful sense of humor. He was a prankster, he was a jokester, he was full of life. Everything you read, he's just larger than life when he shows up. He's an excellent horseman. He is very clear-headed, direct, and decisive. He's a strong leader, and he was very much concerned for the people. And so his concern for the people and their love for him were mutual. And I think that that, in addition to, of course, his strong voice, he had a powerful voice, which is going to be and very much an asset in this time period. He excels when he is at the camp meetings, those outdoor revivals before churches were built. Now, remember, it takes time to build a church, but we were still having these kinds of prayer meetings outdoors without the enclosure of a church building. He's marvelous at those revivals. He has a very strong presence and he brings people to Christ in droves, according to everything I've ever read. That plus his size, which is talked about repeatedly, that he's over 6 feet, he's 250 pounds. He's a big man and he's a rugged man. He talks about sleeping outdoors. He's been beaten, he's been robbed. I mean, he's really lived, his body is taking a toll. And he had a prodigious memory, and so he could quote long Bible verses. He could really bring people to salvation fairly quickly. And I think all of those things contributed to his success. And the other piece about him on the Underground Railroad, and there are so many facets to the man. He has committed his life to the end of slavery. He sees it for the injustice that it is. He would stop short of nothing to end slavery. And I think that that kind of powerful stand in the face of opposition was very helpful for him. But the other piece about him is that while he's establishing all of these churches, he is establishing schools to go along with them. So the Sabbath school or Sunday school is really the forerunner for education for African American children and African American people in general. In this oppositional environment that Quinn is facing, one of his strategies of resistance is literacy. Places like Indiana, Illinois, and Ohio, places you wouldn't necessarily expect, have black codes that restrict learning. And Quinn is determined that he is going to bring not only spiritual salvation, he's also going to bring education to the masses, and he's going to bring financial literacy. And so that's a powerful combination of strategies that he's bringing for the full liberation of his people, and they love him for it.
From the perspective of writing as craft, can you talk about sources and what your challenges were in really putting this narrative together? Because he lived into his 80s and he covered half of the continental US and Canada.
In Canada, yes. This was a challenge to write. I have always felt that in order to do strong African American history, at least for me, that one has to cover multiple disciplines. So I'm a really a transdisciplinarian, multidisciplinarian. I cover history, geography, African American history, archaeology, anthropology, oral history, religious history, you name all these different things that I feel I needed to understand Paul Quinn's life. If you think about this man, he's well known within the AME Church. There are 42 churches named for him across the country. His name is, in some ways, a household word inside of the AME Church. But he is not well known beyond that. And much of the history that has been written was written inside of African Methodist Episcopal documents. But to move beyond that, Newspapers were very helpful, and often sometimes historians don't want to rely on those things, but I didn't have the luxury of tossing those out because this is where I see him being mentioned, particularly after he is rising up as a bishop and achieving sort of fame in this country. Before that, I relied on Ancestry.com. I relied on notations in New York City where I know he's in these meetings, and you can find him in much of the historical record in New York. But many New York historians overlooked him because his name was misspelled. Sometimes it was Guin, sometimes it was Quin, and it was hard to put it all together to say, oh, we are speaking about the same individual. I used a lot of maps because maps are wonderful because they generally don't lie. People don't move a mountain or they don't move things and tell you it's over there when it's over here. They're generally fairly accurate. Now, they might not label what is there, but they generally don't erase what is there. And so I was able to trace him when I would look at a newspaper article and they'd give me an address. I could go to that address on a map and look. So everything was fair game. And that's how I was able to piece together the life of someone who was both known and unknown at the same time.
So it sounds like on his travels, he wasn't writing letters, at least letters that survived, that could give you a glimpse of his
Oh,
thoughts.
if only he had, if only he had. The Christian Recorder is the official newspaper for the AME Church. He writes some of his reports back to the Christian Recorder, and we see those. He does write one manifesto that I've never seen the original, but that has been reproduced, and I use that. But in terms of a cache of letters from him, no. I would suspect, however, because he covers so many states, that buried in some archive somewhere are going to be some of these documents that we're looking for. I was inside of the Ohio History Center when I found Elaine Welsh's biography of Paul Quinn, which was the goldmine and the foundation for much of the anecdotes and the stories that I was able to tell. When I first began the book, I left a lot of those out because, they're secular and I was looking at the religious figure. But as I continued to write, I realized that I was editing his life in a way that wasn't my responsibility. And I went back and included many of those stories, some of which talk about him as a prankster and a jokester, and that he's a boxer. He never backs down from a fight. I left that out in the beginning because I wanted to respect the bishop, but then I figured I was not doing service to the man. And so I put those all in there, and he's rough. He'll fight you.
It's a fascinating narrative. I hope this book will inspire congregations to do more work in terms of their history.
Well, I often run workshops for research on the Underground Railroad because you may know how to do your church research, but it's very different to do Underground Railroad research. And individual churches, many of which say, we are an Underground Railroad church. And every time I heard that, I paid very close attention to that, in part because the AME Church contains a narrative of the Underground Railroad that predates much of the popular sort of, what we have in the 20th century. They had that narrative from the beginning, and I find that deeply important, along with their role in education and in the leadership for education. And all of these AME colleges that you still see existing today speak to that as well. And that was all in part due to Quinn's influence, whether directly or through the bishops that he ordained subsequently.
Well, this is a excellent addition to American history. Thank you so much, Cheryl LaRoche.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
That was author and scholar Cheryl LaRoche speaking with fellow biographer Kevin Magruder about her latest book, Apostle of Liberation: AME Bishop Paul Quinn and the Underground Railroad. It was published this month by Roman and Littlefield, and this interview was recorded this month as well via Zoom. To learn more about Bio or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. I'm bio member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. Darren Neblett created our theme music. And until next time, thanks so much for listening and have a wonderful day.